Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Hello. Thank you for coming
to
the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot press conference. I'm going to bring everyone out if everyone is ready. First, Tina Fey. Writer Robert Carlock.
Beautiful.
Director John Renqua and Glenn Ficarra. Author Kim Barker, and co-star Margot Robbie. Come on in, everybody.
This is my first Comic-Con.
Really?
Smaller than I thought.
I think you guys spelled my name wrong.
I'm going to ask a few questions, and then I'll take it out to the audience as soon as I can. Robert, I'm going to start with you.
Sure.
You've obviously had a long, successful career writing comedy. However, this film is certainly not a straight comedy. What were some of the challenges in adapting Kim's book, and how did you make sure not to lose this sort of great midlife coming-of-age story to too many jokes?
Midlife, Tina?
Well, midlife when my book, Kim was much younger, but midlife when it's...
Yeah, well, I mean, Kim's book as a starting place was just empowering to be able to approach this subject comically. And it was a line to walk, and I think John and Glenn get most of the credit for figuring that out.
Don't blame us.
Credit, I said.
Yeah.
When I was working on it, I would... People would say, oh, you're working on a feature, what is it? I say, it's a comedy about Afghanistan, and everyone would kind of raise an eyebrow, and good luck with that. But when I would talk about it with Kim's friends and their friends and my friends of mine who were journalists over there or in the military over there or NGO workers, whatever, they would all say, oh, I have so many hilarious stories to tell you. And that really helped me get my head around how do you walk this line? And it's just that when people are people in a place, funny things happen, and darkly funny things and tragically funny things. They make funny things happen. They live their lives. That was just something I had to be mindful of all the time.
Thank you. John and Glenn, talk about your process a bit. Who first read the script for this film, or did either of you read the book first? And who gets to decide what project you both direct?
We haven't read the script yet.
Yeah. Nor the book.
I think, Glenn, you read the script first, right?
Yeah, I think, yeah. I don't remember. I think it was pretty much the same weekend, though, right?
Yeah.
Called you on Friday night and said, you got to read this tomorrow. But it immediately jumped off the page within, on the first page, just the description of the house and everything really made me perk up and go, oh, okay, I can tell already this isn't, you know, typical comedy fare, which I thought it was, and as it was pitched to me. And I couldn't put it down. And by the time I got to the end, I was like, okay, you know, John, you got to read this. I think this is kind of got our name on it because of the balance between comedy and drama.
Tina, first, you deliver a terrific performance in this movie. Was it scary for you to know that this role had quite a bit of drama in it, that there wouldn't be a joke waiting for you at the end of a line of dialogue? And how did you find out about Kim's story?
First I found out about the book because I think was it the Times review where it's like,
yes.
You just said, like, this is like a Tina Fey character. And because I'm an egomaniac and a moron, that really spoke to me.
No, I paid her for that.
I got an incredibly unimaginative, yeah. So I got a hold of the book that way. Love the book, found it. So, you know, for me, when you look at something like that, when you read a book for enjoyment, it's one thing. When you read a book also thinking, could this be a movie? When you see things, events, moments that to me were so fascinating and strange and funny and cinematic, I hoped. So I definitely thought it really should be a movie and took it to Lorne Michaels and to Robert, who I thought would be really well qualified to try to adapt it. And then in terms of, whether it's drama or not, I think, you know, again, the book is funny, and I think no life experience is wholly dramatic. In real life, people in the most dire situations must cope through humor, find humor in these things. And so I thought there was a real honesty that way in the book, and the hope is that you just, you try to perform honestly, and where there are jokes or not, it'll be fine.
Kim. So Tina Fey's playing you in a movie. That's pretty
She's
cool.
She's playing Kim Baker.
Yeah.
Legally.
Talk about that, and also what Whiskey Tango Foxtrot gets right about your experiences as a war reporter.
Well, I mean, obviously, when I found out that Tina was going to play me in a movie, I was excited. I mean, if there are any print journalists in the audience, you could probably relate how strange that is and how rare that is. I mean, the guys over there nodding, you'd probably like Tina Fey to play you in a movie, right? Yeah. It was very exciting. And, I met a lot with Robert during the process, and he was always very honest with me about the likelihood of getting a comedy made about Afghanistan. Not likely, and just honest with me about the process and about how, you know, it's not going to adhere directly and strictly to the book, but his whole goal was to make it adhere to the spirit of the book and to keep my narrative arc accurate. And I feel like I've seen it now twice. The first time I was terrified, obviously. I was practically holding hands with my brother, you know, and he's like, it's great. It's like Bridesmaids meets, The Hangover meets something really sad and meaningful. And you come away with a moral at the end of it. And I'm like, you had half of your Hollywood analogy there, but you need to say, like, you know, it's like, you know, Bridesmaids meets The Hurt Locker or something like that. I'm really pleased with it, and I think that it is really accurate to my narrative arc and to the absurdity of how we lived over there and to the sadness that we saw and to the war that continues to go on in Afghanistan and the fact that it just seems to go on and on. And one thing I really like about the movie is how you have this year every year, and it's kind of like rinse and repeat. It's just going to go on and go over and repeat itself. So I'm really happy with it.
Margot, your character Tanya is a fierce, self-confident killer of a reporter, but there is definitely a great deal of vulnerability underneath that facade. Talk about how you prepared to play such a role, and with working with John and Glenn again and Tina for the first time.
Well, I was, you know, probably halfway through shooting Focus with John and Glenn when I told them, like, whatever project you ever do again, I want to be a part of it. And they said, well, funny you mentioned that, because you should have a read of this script. And then I heard that Tina was going to be playing the lead character, and I thought, oh, what a brilliant learning experience that would be. Just to be able to work with someone like that, it would be really, really helpful for me. So I was very, very eager to jump on board, and yeah, to find Tanya, it was you know, on the page, she's kind of, you know, looking out for herself, and I think it was important to find the vulnerable side of her for sure, and I think it was important to find a genuine friendship between Tina's character and my character, just to warrant. I mean, though they may not have been friends in the real world, I think their friendship was very genuine over there. And I think I love watching genuine friendships on screen. I love those bromances when there's like two guys that are friends, and like whatever the dynamic is, a genuine friendship for me is entertaining despite the circumstances that they're in. So it was fun finding that, and it was. Great to get to do it with John and Glenn again, and for the first time with Tina. I'm very, very lucky.
Thanks. John and Glenn, I was particularly impressed with the accuracy and the portrayal of the military in this film. Can you talk about what went into getting that so right?
We had to sleep with a lot of people.
That's just sort of a blanket answer for any of the questions.
Any of the realism.
Robert, actually, I think it started with Robert. I'm pawning it off to you, buddy.
Okay.
It started with Robert. I mean, he worked a lot. I mean, the script, it was there in the script. We just, we built on it. And a lot of it had to do with Ian Bryce, who had a lot of connections in the military, high up and down low. And we were able to get amazing access. And that's why the movie looks like it does. Really, in many ways, is because of our producer Ian Bryce's connection to the military. But I mean, you want to talk about how you?
This movie was so daunting to write because I felt like I had to try to get Kim's experience right, and I had to try to get things that are very important to people, life and death stuff, right. And so I was just talking to a lot of people, and then you show up on the day and the consultant says it wouldn't happen that way, and then you adjust or you argue it or whatever, but it was just effort, I guess, just trying to be true to it.
Tina, war comedy seemed like a dead genre despite our country being at war now for quite some time. Talk about the challenges of making a movie with comedy and heart that is set in a war zone,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the inevitable comparisons to classic comedies like MASH.
Right. There actually are so many great war comedies. And this, you know, this movie at its core, I think, is a human story. It's about relationships. It's not political. It's not Dr. Strangelove, right? It's about this, a woman who's sort of making a choice to blow up her life as her existing life and go on this adventure, for lack of a better word. And so for me, it was about like these people and these relationships. And maybe it's just not knowing better to know that this is a genre we weren't supposed to be trying to touch.
That's what we usually do.
It didn't seem hard at all until now when you go to try to like sell it to people. Like, maybe we should say that the vehicles transform to robots, and then they fight each other. And listen, you're going to be halfway through the film before you realize that didn't actually happen.
I'll open up to some questions here in front row.
Hi, hello, good morning. Lucero Calderon from Mexico City. Two questions. The first one, I want to know, Tina, about playing the principal role and producing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
How was the experience for you sharing, you know, your brain between these parts? And the other, what can you tell us about the soundtrack? How did you select the music? Because it's very funny and important in some scenes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing I would say that, you know, to be a producer at the same time, you really, you have to work with people that you trust and who are doing their jobs well enough that you're not on the day thinking about, you're just trying to think about what you have to do that day and not be like, are we going to make, how many pages we got today? Like, you're not thinking about that. And so you, and film especially, even more than television, you really, you hire directors to make the movie. It's their movie more than anyone else's once you're there on the day. So that's okay. That's easy to do. You got to talk about soundtrack.
The best thing about actors that are producers is they don't show up late those days because they work because it's against their best interest. As far as the music goes, I don't know. I mean, we just go through a heavy process with the music supervisor, and we start the movie by listening to a lot of stuff that we think might be appropriate and
none
researching.
Of it is.
And not, you end up not using any of it.
That's the rule of music and movies. You make a playlist, and you listen to it, and you get really inspired, and then you try to put it in the movie, and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then... And then you find it's just kind of you explore and you find the, you know, because you it's a tough tone, you know. You're trying to make a dramedy, you're trying to match comedy and drama, and so you have to find the music that you know lives somewhere in between those two worlds. And sometimes you want to, you know, for it to be dramatic, and sometimes you want it to be comedic. So it's tough. It's probably the best part of, you know, of the posting a movie like this is just finding the music.
Tina, you're playing a real person here, even though Kim, wonderful as you are, I'm sure, as a person, is not a well-known figure. So what kind of responsibility did you feel you had to do, you know, with this character versus anything else you've ever done, outside of maybe Sarah Palin?
Right.
And also,
my Kim impression is unbelievable.
My friends are like, she must have spent a lot of time with you.
I mean, I think, you know, this was stuff that Robert and Kim talked about. Like, once you are allowing your story to be adapted in this way, you have to be willing to let go and say, like, oh, these two people that are both very dear to me are going to be one person. And even the shift of making her a television reporter as opposed to a print reporter, those were things that just are more cinematic. And so I wanted Kim to not be mad about the movie. But other than that, this isn't a case where I was, you know, trying to be taller or or sound exactly like her, but to try to find the spirit of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And do you think the movie gives, I don't know about the book, but the movie gives sort of a bleak view of what it takes for a woman to be a war zone reporter?
I don't think so at all. I think it points out how there's some real absurdities to it, and especially in that part of the world that you just could be doing your job and someone could just full tilt grab your ass.
Yeah.
And it's not that weird.
You have to learn to punch. You should read the book.
Yeah. Yeah, you punch people in the face. But no, I don't think it's so weird because it wasn't like anyone was afraid to send you there or didn't want your stories because you were a woman.
Right.
It's
equally, I mean, it's equally the same for, I mean, in terms of addiction and getting really into the story over there, I think it's equally the same for men and women. You know, and there are some people who just go from war zone to war zone. And I certainly miss it every single day. It's hard to do, but it is really, it makes you feel very alive doing it. And you feel like you're watching history unfold right in front of you. And it's a privilege to be able to write those stories and to cover those stories as a TV journalist. And I think that, like, I don't really get a bleak sense of it.
Yeah.
I just think it shows how hard it is. It is hard.
Hi, Tina. Carlos Desert Hollywood. I enjoyed the scene between Kim and Fahim where you guys sort of went your separate ways.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pretty much implying that you're, like, getting very high off of the idea of living this life of constant danger. What was shooting that scene like? And at some point, did Kim finally realize that Fahim was right the entire time?
Yes, I think she definitely does. I think in that moment, she started suspecting that he's right. I mean, a scene like that is a pleasure to shoot because I knew that Robert had written this beautiful monologue for Chris Abbott, and Chris Abbott is so good. He's so good. And that as the other actor in that scene, it's just... all you have to do is listen to him and react to him, and he's doing such beautiful work, and the words are so great that it was, I mean, like a great scene to shoot for me because he's doing all the heavy lifting and doing such a good job. So I think it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, also. It's really sort of summing up a lot of what the whole movie is about. Is like you're getting addicted to this lifestyle, and it's dangerous, and I don't want to be a part of this anymore. Yeah, he's real good.
Hi, it's interesting that that was brought up because that was actually related to my question. This is for Tina and Margot. There was that really great scene in the movie where there's sort of a warning that this is unreality. This is not reality. Mm-hmm. This is something that even though you enjoy it, it could get dangerous because it is addictive. So I'm wondering, is there anything about, you know, the living an actor's life that you feel is a lot of fun, could be addictive and possibly dangerous? And also, I'd like to, the second part of my question is, so Margot, I know that you've traveled a lot. You've been quoted as saying you enjoy going to hostels sort of anonymously. I'm wondering, you know, as people who travel a lot, what was the most important thing you learned about, you know, this particular movie, the customs that, you know, you found fascinating or, you know, even, you know, just the opposite of that, you found very uncomfortable. So
you've traveled more than I have.
I love traveling. I really like immersing myself in a different culture, and I feel like you get to do that more when you stay in, like, hostels, and when you're in a hotel, you can kind of be anywhere in the world. They all kind of look the same to an extent. So that's why I like to travel like that. As for becoming desensitized to your surroundings, I think that's applicable for a lot of occupations, and I'd hate to draw any comparisons between being an actor and a war correspondent, because I think they're worlds apart. But I do think the metaphor of the whole frog in a pot boiling is very applicable to a lot of occupations. And yeah, I think it's definitely prevalent. I think it's easy to lose sense of reality when you get caught up in something that's such an adrenaline rush sometimes. But yeah, like I said, I think a lot of people and a lot of jobs kind of do that. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think actually it's such a so much smaller scale and so much less important. But you're like, I'm in the middle of this project. I can't go to my cousin's wedding. I'm in the middle of this project. You know, it's like you can kind of get addicted to that feeling of like, I'm very special and important right now. And you're not.
Hi, this movie has some interesting things to say about being a Western woman in the Middle East, and there's that terrific line about now you're in the purple prison when Tina puts on the burqa.
Yeah.
I wonder if you guys could speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, we did not really travel to Asia or to the Middle East at all, so we are just sort of guessing what it felt like, but and Kim should actually answer more of what it's really like to feel that over there as a Western woman, to feel like, because I'm always fascinated when journalists go like, okay, I'm going to play along and I'm going to wear the headscarf on the news, or I'm going to go in the full blue. Like, it's, you should answer this because you've actually done it.
It's actually a direct quote from Farouk when he said, now you're in the blue prison. And that's actually directly from the book. And just like I always have to say that Afghanistan is in South Asia, not the Middle East, because
yeah,
it always gets sort of conflated and they're very different cultures. And it's just, it's weird, you know. When I first went over there, I had to bring brown contact lenses, you know, because I have blue eyes, and it's what makes me look like a Westerner. And I'm 5'10", and I had to blend in. There's no blending in for me, right? It would be like I would be sitting in a car, and I could blend into a bed if I was wearing a full abaya and I was wearing the brown contact lenses. And then if I was sitting in a car and wearing a burqa, I could blend in. And so a lot of times when we were traveling around, that's what I would wear just so that nobody would sort of notice us. We'd travel around and beat up Toyota Corollas outside the cities. We didn't have security. You know, it was all about trying to look like we were locals and not raising anybody's attention. You know, but it was like there were times, you know, when you're wearing these things and you feel very constricted. But then there was a real freeing sense to it as well, because for the first time you're wearing something that makes you completely invisible and nobody's staring at you anymore and nobody's trying to take your picture or pinch you. You are just, you know, you can relax. And I did not mind that feeling. And it also reminds you every single day how lucky we are to be born here. I mean, this is like, you know, as women, we're very lucky to be born here. And I don't think it's something we think about often enough.
Thank you. Elsa Lopez from Glamour Mexico. For Tina and Margot, what was the most challenging thing to play your characters, but at personal level, because it seems that the characters were very well constructed, so I think it was hard. And for Robert, John, and Glenn, the difficult part of, well, the most challenging part of directing and making this movie, what was? And Kim, how was it to see all of this story again in the big movies?
Well, go.
For parts. Thank you. Thank you.
And then dance.
I mean, I think for me the most challenging thing personally would be was trying to pretend we were there, because to really sort of imagine the feeling of danger, because we were in New Mexico, we were in the United States, to do that, because everything else was there for us, the words were there, the characters were so well drawn, so that for me was the biggest challenge.
I agree. It is difficult having no exposure to what it would be like to be a war correspondent. I did like a lot of reading about things that we weren't actually talking about in the script necessarily, but, you know, the things that would happen to reporters over there, just so that I could recognize the stakes that we would technically be in and try and bring that fear to a scene. Like, it's not all fun and games the way, you know, sometimes, you know, the scenes in the fun house, it is fun, but when we're out, you know, actually doing an embed or whatever it is, like, it's a real life and death situation. So I just tried to read about it so I could kind of get a grasp of the stakes. And I think with the actual, like, character storylines, I think a lot of the things are kind of universal things that people experience anyway, so that you can kind of draw on your own experiences for that. But, yeah. Definitely difficult not actually being there and not actually feeling the imminent danger the way they would have been.
I think the hardest thing by far, I think early on, what I said to you, Robert, I said, you know, we have to recreate a city in New Mexico, and just the huge task of recreating a city, a cobble, and a country in New Mexico was really daunting. And I think we were trying to do it in a convincing way. So the actors, when they came on set, they were like, okay, well, it's a little easier for them to imagine and be immersed in that world. So it was a big task, and we wanted to build it for real. I mean, there's a lot of sort of digital tricks in the movie, but there's a lot of giant sets that we built as well. And we didn't have a lot of money and a lot of time, but we felt like it was important to actually have the actors go into places that were real, that were completely immersive. And that was, I think, what nearly killed us.
It was a big challenge because it's not a large budgeted movie. And I just have to mention Galera Kiazand, who did our second unit photography in Kabul. She's a Turkish correspondent and filmmaker, and she went in for us because Paramount wouldn't let us go for a couple of days and get some stuff. So she went, and she's really key to this whole thing. She really did an amazing job.
And I would just say, Kim had mentioned sort of her real-life narrative arc earlier, and I think the biggest challenge in writing the thing and adapting it was knowing that that was the spine and that was the truth of this thing, and then trying to figure out, okay, how do I take this beautiful, funny book that reflects real life and be true to all of that, while giving it the kind of moments that a movie requires narratively and all that stuff without making Kim furious at me.
How did we do?
I think you did really well.
Because I've never been there. I don't know.
I got to say, in watching it, it looks like Afghanistan. It looks like Kabul. I was impressed. Because when you're on set, I saw maybe 2 minutes of it filmed, and I was a bit skeptical, but we were just doing explosions and things like that when I was there. And as far as your question, what was it? What was it like? It was weird. Yeah.
Hi. So, Kim, I know you wrote about this code of silence for female journalists when encountering sexual harassment, and the film kind of touches on that too. So I was just wondering if that's something you notice the situation has improved for journalists now, and to Margot and Tina, if that sort of if you feel like that applies to the entertainment industry as well.
Do you guys want me to take that one first?
Yeah, can you take that? Yeah. I want to work again.
Okay, all right. I mean, I haven't been overseas since I came back, but I think that what has changed is there's been a lot more attention about it, in large part because
Laura Logan was so brave to talk about what happened to her. And I think, you know, Lindsay Addario has talked about it. Even male journalists have talked about it. And I think a lot more people are talking about it. And, you know, the fear in talking about it in the first place is that, is this going to mean that I'm not as tough and that, like, my editor's not going to send me overseas anymore or say, you know, you want to come back here for a hug? You know, it's like if you're overseas, you sort of feel like you got to take care of everything yourself and you don't want to complain back home because there's a line of people that like to come out the door and do the job you're doing. So I, you know, and you talk to other reporters, but you sort of, it's always like the black humor thing. So I think that what's happened, and Lauren Wolf has done a lot of work on this as well, is that people are talking about that. And I think it's only a good thing if people are talking about it. And everybody should remember that we're the foreign reporters there, and this is what's happened with us. And with the local reporters, they obviously suffer much more. And you're talking about men and women, you know. So I'd always like to point that out. Now you get to answer the question, guys.
I've been very fortunate. I mean, I've got a really good team around me. I haven't been exploited, I don't feel. I think it's as much, I guess, the perception and the persona to the masses as it is to the people that you're immediately surrounded by. I think I feel more concerned with being labeled like a sex symbol to like everyone than I do. I don't feel like I feel that makes me more uncomfortable than any day-to-day interactions I ever have. I don't feel exploited.
Yeah, again, like Kim said before, we're lucky to be born here. Yeah. You know, mild complaints in the U.S., but very lucky.
Hello. Congratulations, everyone, on the movie. Well done. It was fantastic. Kim, I wanted to talk to you specifically about, or if you could address the transition of just covering the war versus becoming a part of it and what that's like to be able to affect it directly as opposed to just being there reporting on it. And Tina, has doing this project specifically changed your viewpoint on political comedy at all and how you approach it? And, you know, because when you parody something, if you're not directly involved, you can see the funnier a lot easier, I think, mm-hmm. as opposed to working directly with someone who is affected by it.
Do you want to go first?
I don't care. You want to go first?
So I think, well, in terms of, like I said, I don't think of this movie as political comedy particularly because it's more human story than that. But I think the same things apply that you want to try to get the facts and background right, whether it's a political sketch or this movie, and you want to feel like that any observations or jokes you are making are what we would call a fair hit and that they ring true in some way. And then beyond that, you know, it is what it is.
And I would say that I think any time that I guess I would say the difference between covering a war and being in there and sort of being part of it is if you're in D.C., you're covering a war, right? If you're outside of the zone, you're covering it. If you parachute in and you do like an embed, you're just sort of covering it. But if you're based over there, you're living it. There's nobody who's based over there who's not living it because you're essentially working 24 hours a day. I mean, you see this in the movie. You're at a party, there's a boom. Everybody starts working. Everybody stops. And that happened. Like, happened quite often. Or you'd be at a dinner, and all of a sudden, one person would get a call, and they'd slink away, and the next person would get the call. And, like, you'd be sitting there not getting the call, wondering what was going on. So, I mean, it's just, if you're there, you're just in it. And I don't know if you can have an effect on the difference of the war or anything like that. It seemed to me, being over there, that I would see stories coming out of D.C. about what was happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they would just be dead wrong. But mm-hmm. they would be taken as conventional wisdom because they were being written out of the Capitol, as mm-hmm. opposed to what we were seeing happen on the ground. That was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book.
Margo, I was meaning to ask, what was it like preparing for the role of Tanya and also working on Suicide Squad? Did you work on both projects simultaneously, or?
Yeah, I was actually doing the press tour for Focus while shooting this, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, and I was training for Suicide Squad at the same time. So it would kind of be, we'll block shooting my days, so there'd be pretty long days on set, and then I'd train when I wrapped. And then on weekends and things, I'd fly out for the press tour. So it's very busy.
What was the name of your trainer?
Pistol Pete.
Welcome to Hollywood.
We've heard mentioned several times, especially from Robert, about the necessity of doing Hollywood things for adapting the book. And I just wonder for Kim and for Robert about the difference between the realities of what you wrote about and maybe the inventions we have in the movie. What, in other words, what's really fiction here, right, and keeping to the truth?
Well, I mean,
you made the fiction. You answer that.
Yeah, and even the even a lot of the fiction was I think I said this at one point to Kim when we were meeting early, but she was always very. It was very helpful. Well, I think the first time I sat down with you, you said something like, I know you have to combine people. I know you have to add stuff. I know you have
to you're going to get rid of Pakistan.
Yeah, I know you're going to get rid of Pakistan.
I know I'm going to have a romance with, Sean. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, which is remarkable. I guess she just likes money. One of the things I think I said to her was like, if the Attorney General of Pakistan, of Afghanistan has a crush on your main character, that can't just be a funny condition. Something has to happen with that narratively. I mean, you can't just get handed that. Those things did happen, the bed, and he, not with Kim, but he did famously dance at a party that was sort of his political undoing. I was like, all right, well, I can use that real thing and then try to build, okay, how does she use him in the end? How does she use that affection? That's not something that our real Kim did, manipulate the Attorney General of Afghanistan. But it's like...
She did not rescue my boyfriend.
Yeah, but you could have.
I could have.
It's just the thing of if there's a gun in the first act, it has to go off. And Kim's book is full of guns, and my job was to sort of make him go off.
Oh, and was I supposed to answer something in that question?
Sure.
Yeah. What was...
How
did I feel about it?
Yeah.
It's Hollywood, and I think that I've talked to a lot of friends who've had books made into movies or optioned to be made into movies, and their advice was, sign it and wait to see what they do with it, and if they need your help, offer your help, but you can't get too wrapped up in it. I've always been like in my job, I can only control the things I can control. Mm-hmm. So while they were doing this, I was actually working as a reporter and doing actual stories and focusing on that and trusting that the team would do a really good job.
Hi, Jenny Matthew from AFP. Pakistan was obviously completely taken out of the movie. Can you talk a little bit about the decision process behind that? I mean, was it just about simplifying the narrative, or were there other decisions behind that?
Yeah, it was just about simplifying the narrative. It's and to me, as a dumb American, Afghanistan, I could get my mind around. I did a lot of reading about Pakistan, and it's even more complicated, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Our allies, who are also... funding the
Taliban. The worst frenemy in the world.
The worst frenemy in the world. Like, boy, that's a great other movie. And there's some wonderful that Steve Cole book and some great stuff to read about it. But looking at a narrative that's really about a woman going through a personal journey and it just fell away immediately, unfortunately. So you shouldn't have done any of that, Kim.
I mean, you had to lose the iPhone scene, which was, always a tragedy.
Yeah.
We were hired because we were told it was a trilogy. It was going to be a movie.
This is, South Asia trilogy.
My question is for Tina and Margot. Can you talk about working with such a great supporting cast like Martin Freeman, Billy Bob Thornton, and the other ones?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's just so educational, and to get to work with Martin and Alfred and Billy Bob and Margot, these people that I really, really admire in other roles, you just try to keep up with them, you just try to, it's like playing tennis with someone who's a much better tennis player, you just like hope that your game comes up a little bit, don't you think?
It was hilarious. Everyone was so funny. I remember we'd do takes, and I would blatantly be on camera just pissing myself laughing.
Yeah.
And I was like, they can't use any of my coverage because I'm just laughing at everyone else. there was a lot of improvised stuff, which unfortunately didn't make the cut. So I wish you guys could have seen it, but it was, you can take my word for it, it was hilarious. Stephen Peacock, Martin, yeah. Like, they were so good. Sheila, too.
Sheila's great.
So funny.
The 3-hour version of the movie is fantastic.
Yeah.
A lot more dolphin stuff.
Yeah.
Dolphin. Was that improvised?
Yeah.
That was hilarious.
Yeah,
like,
that's
awesome. Going with it.
It was so funny.
Hi, this question is for Margo. What initially attracted you to this role, especially as a female character? There were some negative characteristics of her, and how did you deal with that and humanize those?
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think the most important thing for me was to find a genuine friendship between them, and that kind of made everything else a little easier after that. She's obviously a very opinionated character, but I think it can be... I think when there's something genuine about what you're trying to portray, it doesn't matter as much if it's not necessarily a positive thing you're trying to portray, as long as it's genuine. I just thought it was a strong character. I love strong characters, whether they're right or wrong, whether they're good or bad. It's always fun and easier to play a strong character when you know you have strong opinions on things. And like I said, I was really excited to work with everyone sitting at this table and... do something a little different.
Time for one more question. Right over here.
Hi, this is a question for Kim. I'm wondering, what does it really take to be a war reporter? Is it courage? What are the characteristics? Is it something that you can really prepare for? How do you see yourself?
I don't see myself as particularly brave. I grew up, I was very scared of everything. I think it takes curiosity and the desire to challenge yourself to do things that really scare you, but primarily curiosity about the world and about, like, seeing history again unfold right in front of you. And bravery just sort of follows behind, like, about 6 steps, going, like, what the hell did you do to us? Like, all of a sudden we're in Afghanistan. I mean, I went to Pakistan and Afghanistan before I ever went to Europe, you know? Seriously. It's like I was not traveled at all. And I did not know what I was getting into at all. Maybe that's the key to being a foreign correspondent. Have no knowledge whatsoever of where you're going. Wing it from there.
Thank you, everyone. If you could all stay in your seats while they all exit the stage.
Thank you
so much.
I suggest everyone go and see Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. It will be worth every penny. I'm serious. So it comes out in March. This is Dr. Summer Reed, and I'm the publisher of Healing Hands Magazine.